All right, good morning, City Light Benson. How y'all doing? Doing good? Usually I say you guys look very beautiful today, but I must say you look pretty ugly today. Do you like my sweater? I call it Revelation Kitty. Revelation Kitty. He's very angry. He's judgment, right? Judgment before joy is his motto. So thanks for just leaving your pride at the door and dressing up today and having fun. It's so good to see you guys. All right, so we're in an Advent series up until Christmas, and we're going through the book of Ruth, right? In the book of Ruth, especially in chapter 3, it's one of the most provocative chapters in the Bible. Okay, and I just want to let you know out of the gate that I'm going to keep this thing PG for us all today, right? I know there's parents in the room. I got my son, Zane, in the room over here. It's hard being a PK, you know, let alone being embarrassed by your dad. So, hi, Zane. I'm going to keep this thing PG today. All right, so as we travel through the book of Ruth, there are three main characters that I want to remind us of as we head into the story, right, to give some context. We have Naomi, we have Ruth, and we have Boaz. Now, Naomi was in Israel, and there was a famine, and so her husband and her two sons and her went to a foreign land named Moab there to live with the Moabites. And tragically, Naomi's husband and her two sons passed away while she was there. And so she was lonely, and she decided to go back to home, back to Israel. And Ruth was one of her daughter-in-laws, and she was loyal to Naomi. She was best friends with Naomi, and so she traveled back to Israel with her. And so they were poor. They were kind of hopeless. Ruth was sent to the fields to pick up scraps, to glean some food, to take back so she could eat and survive and give some scraps to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And Naomi, we see God's sovereignty here, or Ruth, happened to be in the field of a man named Boaz. And every time I say that this morning, ladies, when you hear the word Boaz, I want you to go, ah, Boaz, because Boaz is the hero. Boaz is the man, all right? And so keep that in mind as we go along here. All right, I want some crowd participation, okay? All right, so here's the outline today. Here's the plot lines as we go through the story. We're going to see Ruth and Naomi's need. We're going to see the solution to their need, the plan, the proposal, and the resolution. Okay, so let's jump in now to the story in verse 1 to find out their need. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" She says, "Should I not seek your rest, daughter?" So right away, in verse 1, we see their need. We see their problem. The thing that's most on their minds right now in the story is that they are tired, they are restless, and they are hungry. Ruth desperately needs rest. That's their need. As a reminder, the world that they're living in is not the world that we live in. The world at the time was dark and gloomy. Right in chapter 1 of Ruth, we see that they were living in the time of the judges. And if you flip back to the book of Judges, chapter 21, verse 25, it explains kind of the gloomy reality that they were living in. It says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." So literally, that's the world they were living in. Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. Okay, there was no king ruling and reigning, working for peace. Spiritual leaders were corrupt. Healthy churches were hard to find. They were experiencing a famine. Things were not good for them. And so as we read Naomi's words, they ring really loudly to us when she says, "My daughter, should I not seek your rest?" Right? Rest is what they desperately needed. And to make matters worse, being a woman in that period was very, very hard. We look back to chapter 2, and we see that Boaz, who's a stand-up guy, had to tell his workers, who he probably hired, which most of them were probably stand-up men as well, he told his workers this in chapter 2. He said, "Do not lay a hand on Ruth." So that's a signal to us that men probably did that quite often, that was quite a common occurrence in that day is for women to be assaulted. So women were very, very vulnerable in that day. And so Ruth and Naomi here desperately need protection, they need rest, they need food. That's their need. And so now we're going to look in verse 2 to see what their solution is. How are they going to solve this problem? So verse 2 says this, "Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So as they think about their problem, where does their minds turn? As they think about their problem, what kind of solution do they come up with? Well, they look to Boaz, the man Boaz. Ladies, remember what I said? Boaz. Yes, that's right. He's the man. And they're going to go to a man for their solution, right? Now, I want you to see, ladies, that this man has a job, right? A real job. He's winnowing barley. I don't even know what winnowing barley even means, right? But I know it's a job. It's a real job. So young ladies, take note that when you're looking for a man, right, out of all of the millennial men out there that still live with their parents in their basement with Star Wars pajamas, take note that this man has a real job, okay? That's a very, very important as you look at your dating qualities list. Now, and he's winnowing barley, right? That just sounds manly, right? It sounds like a manly job. Now, Naomi here says something weird. I think it's weird. Maybe you don't think it's weird. But she says, is not Boaz our relative? That's a little weird, isn't it? Like, ladies, if you were having the boy conversation with your mom, and she says, well, honey, I know a relative. Like, that just would not come off very good, would it? Like, dear, you know, have you thought of a great Uncle Boaz? Like, he's quite the catch. He's quite the catch. No, like, what is going on here? What is she doing? Now, that sounds very, very strange to our ears, but it was not strange, but very shrewd of Naomi to mention that. Why? Because her suggestion was rooted in a particular custom in ancient Israel known as the kinsman redeemer, a redeemer that is of your kin or of your extended family. And so the Hebrew word for this is goel. Goel meant kinsman redeemer. Now, according to the law, which they would have known, according to the law, there is different responsibilities placed on the goel. And here are a few of those responsibilities. So Leviticus 25:48 states that if an extended family member is a slave, it was your responsibility to buy them out of slavery. Numbers 35:19 states that if a family member was murdered, that it was up to the goel to go and avenge the death, to make sure that the guilty parties were punished. And Leviticus 25:25 states that if the land of an extended family member is forfeited, that they had a responsibility to go and help and go and buy back that land. And then lastly, and most importantly for our story today, Deuteronomy 25:5-10 states that if a family member becomes a childless widow, right, that should sound familiar. If she becomes a childless widow, that it was the goel's responsibility to marry that person to carry on the family name. I mean, how amazing is that? Is if you were a widow in that day, and there are a lot of widows because of the warfare, people dying in wars, but if you're a widow, that a redeemer could come in, help you bear children and carry on your family name so that it wouldn't die, so the lineage could keep going. Right, so a goel, a kinsman redeemer, was coveted in that society. So Naomi here is not someone who is inappropriately telling Ruth, hey, here's how you can be a gold digger to save yourself. No, she's not saying that. She's saying, hey, Ruth, you can put your faith in the God-designed, God-given gift of a family redeemer. Let's take advantage of that. Right, so if I were to tell you their solution in one word, like what is Naomi and Ruth's solution that they come up with, I would say, a man. Their solution is a man. And we don't quite understand that, but in their day, a man could provide everything that they needed. But they were living in a patriarchal context. Okay, in that patriarchal context, especially in the volatile days of the judges, when things were kind of crazy, things like rest, food, shelter, and protection were wrapped up in belonging to a man. So women were much more dependent on men than they are today. And so Ruth is seeing this and putting her faith. Hey, I think I want to take Naomi's advice. I want to go after this. Like, this sounds like a great deal. So she really has two options on the table. One is to labor day in and day out in the fields for her rest, or two, go to a man who would then labor for her rest. But she could strive and glean in the fields for a very long time for her rest, or she could give herself to a man who would labor for her rest. So those are the two options. And so you could say that the biggest decision of Ruth's life is it comes down to a decision around one man, right? Around one man. And I would say for us, for me and for you, the biggest decision of our lives revolves around what we're going to do with one man, right? And I'll put the pause button on that and come back to that in a little bit. So let's look at their plan now. Ruth and Naomi pick option number two, pursue the man, pursue Boaz. Therefore, Naomi now huddles up with Ruth and gives her the game plan, gives her the instructions to go about how to execute this plan. So let's pick it up in verse 3. Naomi, the mother-in-law, says to Ruth, "Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." Right? So let me translate this for you in for modern ears, right? This is the Message remix version right here. Go take a shower, she tells Ruth. Go take a shower, put on some perfumes, get smelling good. Go down to the work site, spy on Boaz until he gets a little buzzed, and he falls asleep on the threshing floor. Sneak up to him stealthily, uncover his feet, whatever that means, and lie down with him. Right? If that sounds a little sketchy, it's because it is. It is a little sketchy, all right? We know this for a fact because in verse 14, it says, "So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another." So she didn't want to be seen. And Boaz said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." All right, so this is some unorthodox, some risque things going on. Now, to the original Jewish readers or listeners, they would not have been shocked to read this. We're kind of like, what is going on here? This doesn't make much sense. But to them, it wouldn't have been that shocking. Why? Well, because Moabites in that day were known to have a reputation. They were known as being risque women. Now, this goes all the way back to Genesis 19, right? You have a guy named Lot and his two daughters, and it says they travel up to the hill country, all right? So there's no wireless internet. There's no dating sites. There's not a lot of men around to choose from, and so it's just their dad and two daughters. And so, unfortunately, they devise this plan because they really want children. They devise this plan to give their father too much to drink, lie with him on two separate occasions, and they each have a baby. Now, the first daughter's baby, she calls Moab. And the Bible says that boy, Moab, would grow up to be the father of the Moabites. Right? So as you look back at where the Moabites started, it started with an incestuous relationship. Right? Already not off to a great start if you're a Moabite. And then as you travel through the story and after the Exodus, we read in Numbers 25 that Israel had a lot of enemies surrounding them. They had the Ammonites, Moabites, and others surrounding them. And there was a Moabite named by the name of Balaam, and he knew he didn't want to come in and attack Israel. That wouldn't be very effective. So he said, "Let's do something more deceptive." And he pitched this plan to Moabite women to go into the camp of the Israelites, right, to offer favors to these men in exchange for them worshiping false idols and false gods. Right? It was a deceptive plan to turn their hearts away from the God of the Bible. And so as the original Jewish readers were listening to this, they would have Genesis 19, Lot and his daughters in mind. They would have Numbers 25 in mind. So all that to say, Moabites, women, had a reputation. And so as they're reading this, Ruth, a Moabite, hatching this plan of Naomi's to go to the threshing floor, wouldn't have been that shocking to them because they would say, "Hey, this is a Moabite woman doing a Moabite woman thing. This is a Moabite acting like a Moabite." Now, where it's going to change in the story, in the narrative, is when Ruth says some things that are going to utterly shock them, that are going to be an utter contrast to how a Moabite woman would have been expected to behave. And so let's read to find out what happens. And so now we get to the point of the story where the plan is executed, where the proposal is about to take place. So look back with me at the story, starting in verse 6. It says, so she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Now, just a quick side note. JD talked last week about what a stand-up guy Boaz was. And here we see him drinking. We see him passing out on the threshing floor. We start to question, right, what kind of guy this is. We start to question his behavior. But I want to say this, two things. One, the Bible does not say that he actually got drunk. All right, it says he drank until his heart was merry. Right, a little bit of a difference there. And second of all, he just didn't pass out on the threshing floor like a drunk frat guy. He's just not just passing out in random places. But this was a guy who was responsible. You see, we see in 1 Samuel 23 that in the time of the judges, there were lots of thieves. And they would roam around stealing people's hard-earned labor, stealing their grain, stealing their crops. And so Boaz, the reason he was sleeping there day and night was because he was protecting his grain. Right? He was a responsible man. He's still a great man of good character. Right? So I just wanted to say that as a side note about his character in case it's in question. Now, Ruth comes and stealthily uncovers his feet. She lays down with him and wakes up. And he says, kind of half asleep, like, who are you? Am I still dreaming here? Like, who are you? And what she says next is shocking. Right? To the original readers, they would have put down their Bible, got off the lazy boy, and said, no way, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. That's what she would say. Well, what did she say that was so shocking? That was so counterintuitive. That was so different than how a Moabite would have acted in that moment. Well, first of all, she said, I am your servant. I am your servant. You see, in that day, disciples would sit at the feet of their master to show honor and respect and submit to their leadership. Right? They would sit at their feet. That was a custom in that day. And so Ruth here is coming, laying down, sitting at his feet, in a submissive, respectful, honoring posture. Right? That's what she's doing. So where you would have expected her as a Moabite woman to come seducing, she doesn't come seducing, she comes submitting, like giving herself to him, respecting him. Right? So already the tables have been turned. This is not what they would have expected. Second of all, she says, spread your wings over me. Right? Spread your wings over me. What in the world does that mean? Right, that sounds a little strange. Well, it's also the equivalent of saying, spread your garment over me. Right, spread your garment over me. And it might sound like she's using seductive language here, but she's actually using theological language. Right, let me show you. In Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 8, God tells his people this, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became mine. So God himself uses this kind of language when talking to his people. He said, I'm spread my garment over you, which means I'm taking you as my own. I'm going to take responsibility for you. I'm going to love you. I'm going to cover your sins. Right? That's what Ruth is saying to him. She's using theological language, covenantal language. So rather than coming as a typical maybe Moabite woman who's coming to trick him, like Lot's daughters did to him and when he had been drinking too much, she does the opposite. She doesn't come as a consumer. She comes as a covenanter. She comes to commit herself, give herself to this man, Boaz. Again, quite shocking, but that's what she's doing here. So let's see how Boaz responds to this proposal. So she, remember, Naomi said, lay down and he'll tell you what to do. And she gets kind of excited here and she's the one that actually pops the question. She's like, would you take me? Would you marry me? And so let's see what Boaz says. Verse 10. It said, and he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. So as in chapter 2 that JD preached on last week, we saw kind of this resume of Boaz's. Boaz is awesome, Boaz is awesome, Boaz is awesome. In chapter 3 now, we see Ruth shine. We see her character shine. So right in the climax, right in the middle of this chapter, we see Boaz just go off on Ruth's beautiful character. He's going to praise her. He says that she is a worthy woman, which literally in Hebrew means to have. She had a moral strength about her. She had good quality. She had integrity. She had virtue, which means that she made good decisions. And he says specifically about. He talks specifically about the decision she's making in that moment. He praises her for her relationship decision by saying, "Hey, you didn't go after a young man. Like, you didn't have to be here. Like, you could have gone after those young, good-looking men, whether poor or rich." But he says, "You didn't do that. You're acting in wisdom. You're coming to me in faith, claiming me as your kinsman redeemer." That's virtuous. That's beautiful. I think Ruth's character here is such a challenge to us as men and women in our culture, because we live in a culture that tends to pick partners based on outward appearances, don't we? We tend to pick partners based on outward appearances. Yet we see that's different. That's in contrast to God's heart. In 1 Samuel 16:7, we see what makes God's heart sing, like Boaz's. He says, "For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." So what makes God sing is the inner beauty of one's character. Like, that's what God delights in. The problem is that we live in a culture that is so different than that. We live in a culture that focuses on outward appearance. Look at all the dating websites out there. Right? They're training you to look first and foremost at the profile picture. To look at one's outward appearance and making a partner or a dating decision. I love The Voice. Anybody love The Voice in here, the TV show? Yeah. I love The Voice because they pick people not based on their looks, but based on their voice. Right, they're turned away from the singer, and when they want to choose a singer, they hit the button and then turn around and then can see the person. So they pick somebody based on the voice. And that's what God delights in too, is he looks at people's character. He looks at their person rather than the outward appearance. And so we should do the same. Now here are two problems that we're going to run into being in a culture that trains us to look on outward appearances. The first problem is that people with good character get overlooked. Right? People with good character get overlooked all the time. Right? If Ruth was looking for a hunk, right, she would have not gone to Boaz. Right? He was older, probably wasn't as good looking as the younger men. Boaz would have got overlooked, and yet he was the wise decision in this case. He would have gotten overlooked. Likewise, there are young men and young women, even older men, older women in our congregation that we know get overlooked. Right? We know that. But we, like Boaz, we talk well of you all the time. Behind the scenes, we're saying, "Hey, have you seen this person? Have you seen this person? They are killing it. You see their character." And yet it grieves us when we see them get overlooked as they try to date. And so if you're that person this morning, I want to say that we are grieved to see that happen. Like, we don't want that to happen. And we want to encourage you this morning to say that God sees you. Right, though you may have been overlooked in the past and still are being overlooked to some extent, we want to let you know that God sees you, that God sees your character, and that God thinks you are beautiful. He loves you, and he sings about you and praises you the way that Boaz does about Ruth. Secondly, so the first problem is that people with good character get overlooked. Secondly, people with good looks lose it over time. That's another problem of focusing too much on outward appearances. People with good looks lose it over time. So if Ruth was a looker, if she was a hottie with a body, right? it was PG-13, sorry about that. If she was a hottie, right? She was a hottie. Boaz knows that she's not going to keep those looks forever, is she? Right? Everyone, no matter how good they look in their 20s or in their teens, will eventually get old, will get wrinkles, and maybe even get a little flabby, right? Let's just be honest. Might get a little flabby. That's why God says, don't look at the outward appearances, right? Peter tells women in the church this in 1 Peter 3. He says, "Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. So women, as you just think about your own life, like listen to Peter's exhortation here. He says, don't give yourself, don't spend all of your time and energy on outward appearances, on managing your appearances on Instagram or Facebook, showing the world how good you look. Rather, focus your time and energy on your character, because that is what is beautiful in God's eyes. That's what's most precious. Right? So what makes God's heart sing is when we go against the cultural pressure and make character the primary thing that we pursue and celebrate in this church. Let's be counter-cultural, church, when it comes to this. So let me just ask a few questions here. Let me ask the singles in the room first this. What's your main criteria for choosing a partner, a person to date? What's been your main criteria? What have you been fixated on? Right? Could it be possible that you right now are overlooking good men or women because of cultural pressure? Don't overlook them. And let me ask the married couples in this room, right? And even to the singles as well. Are you spending the majority of your time working on your character or simply just managing external appearances? What are you devoting yourself to right now? Right? John Piper gives this extended but amazing quote on where men and women oftentimes spend their energy and the result of it. He says this, "Women should ask, what kind of spirit should I cultivate for my man, as well as how should I eat and dress and exercise for my man? And the man should do the same. What kind of inner spirit, he says, should I have as a husband that makes her flourish? Because there is a kind of spirit in a man that kills a woman or frightens or bores her. And a man shouldn't mainly be pumping iron, because frankly, most women could care very little about what their husbands look like, unless they're just making fools of themselves. They want a spirit, a strength, a humility, a nobility. They want someone to pick them up and sweep them away. In their worst moments, women do not look at pornography, usually. Mostly, they read novels about exciting romances because their husbands are so boring. And so it cuts both ways. I think we husbands should labor not so much with the outward man, and the woman shouldn't labor so much about the outward woman. Rather, we should all cultivate the kind of beauty that we all deeply long for in relationships. A marriage is a relationship. When you're old, gray, wrinkled, overweight, or underweight, squinty, bent over, and hobbling along, maybe you'll be holding hands at 85 because of your inner beauty." Isn't that a great quote? Just a good call for us as a church, as it's a young church. This is the goal, right? To be holding hands with somebody at 85, having cultivated this beautiful character and a beautiful friendship. That's what made God's heart sing. Right? Ruth's character here makes his heart sing. In addition to Ruth's inner character, I think the story, the author, is pointing us to another attribute of Ruth that we can look at as a model for us. He points us to her faithful action. Right? This is a bold woman. I love what Kyle McLennan says about her. Pastor Kyle McLennan is over in Fremont, Nebraska. He's a pastor, and he wrote his dissertation on Ruth. And so we've been gleaning, gleaning some good stuff from his dissertation to share with you all. And here is a quote that I think you guys will enjoy. He says, "Ruth gives us a fuller understanding of what biblical womanhood entails. These women are not wallflowers, nor are they waiting around for Boaz to make up his mind. These are women of action. Their belief in the sovereignty and goodness of God frees them to pursue the rest promised by God in his word. Biblical womanhood does not mean a submissive, listen to this, does not mean a submissive inactivity. Ruth helps us to see that a woman of virtue is also a woman of faithful action." I love that. Women, I know sometimes in Christian churches or in Christian subculture, sometimes women are expected to be seen and not heard. Sometimes women are expected to sit on the sidelines while the men do the work. Sometimes women are expected to wait around for the man to make the first move, and so on and so on. But what I want you to see here is that as Ruth is being elevated as as a model of biblical womanhood, especially coming after Proverbs 31, like JD mentioned last week, right, this model of womanhood, God is saying, this is what I like. I like a woman who is bold. I like a woman who takes risks. I love a woman who runs hard after the promises of God and gets after it. That's what God delights in. And so I just want to say, if you are a woman in this church that are doing those things, but are running hard after the promises of God, I want to say thank you. Like men in this room, do you think that we have some Ruths in our congregation? Yes, we do. Thank you. Thank you for modeling that for us. We want you to know that your boldness and your strong faith and your action is something that is celebrated here and is something that is welcomed here. Keep it up. We love you. Now, to the men, look now at how Boaz is an example to us. Boaz here is a man of decisive action, right? He doesn't wait around, but he takes action right away. Looking at Ruth, he says in verse 12, "And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." And so Alex is going to get into this next week. There's a process that he has to go through at the courthouse because there's a man that's closer in kin to Ruth that has the first decision of whether or not he wants to redeem Ruth. So Boaz is saying, I'm going to go through this process to redeem you, but there's someone else nearer than I that we have to take care of first. But take note that he doesn't wait around. When Ruth says, will you redeem me? Will you take me? He says, absolutely. He says, yes, I'm going to get on this right away. I'm not going to pray about it for a few days, contemplate it for a few days. He says, babe, I'm getting on this right away in the morning. I'm heading into the courthouse. We're going to get this deal done. And so he's a man of decisive action, right? And then he gives her a deposit of his love, right? He gives her some goods to take back with her. Verse 15, and he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and she measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city, and when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So women, again, as you're taking notes on what kind of man you need to be looking for, this man loves her mother-in-law well, right? He takes care of not just her, focuses his attention not just on Ruth, but on her mother-in-law and says, hey, take a gift back for your mother-in-law from me, right? Give her a ton of food here. So women, when you're looking for a man, don't just look at how he treats you, but how he treats your family, and particularly your mother, okay? That's a good man right there. Now, to close, I want to show you guys something really beautiful that I noticed in the text this week, right? Sometimes there's what's called a top and tail. There's something at the beginning of the chapter and the end of the chapter that will signify, right, what this chapter is all about. It'll help give you clarity on the big idea of the chapter. Now, at the very end of the chapter, verse 18, this is what Naomi says, right? Ruth asks for marriage. She runs home to tell her mother-in-law, hey, we're engaged. And this is what Naomi says. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. That is the whole courthouse thing the next day. She says, for the man, that's Boaz, will not rest until he settles the matter today. So she says, hey, he will not rest until he settles this matter and becomes your redeemer. Now, at the very beginning, look at verse 1. She said, this is how the story started. She says, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? So that was their problem. They desperately needed rest. How did a resolution come about? How did a solution come about? Well, at the very end of this chapter, we see the man, Boaz, is not going to rest until he redeems Ruth. He is getting after it. And imagine the kind of hope that that would have given them. Right? At the very beginning of the chapter, they're hopeless. Now, at the end of the chapter, they're hopeful because there's a man who has offered to come and labor for their rest. A man who is willing to go to the plow and work hard so that they might not be restless and without joy any longer. Their solution was found in a man. Like, remember, That's what I said at the very beginning of this talk. I said, the biggest decision of Ruth's life came down to her decision over one man, right? And the biggest decision of our lives, of my life and of your life, is the same. It's, what are we going to do with Jesus Christ, the man Jesus Christ? That is the most important decision we're ever going to make. What a great picture of the gospel, isn't it? That Jesus Christ, the greater Boaz, would come down to the earth and to labor until we would have rest, to labor and work hard until we might be able to rest like Ruth, right? He lived anything but a restful life, right? He came as a poor baby in a manger. He came as a poor baby in a manger just like Ruth was poor. He came as an immigrant, as an outsider, as a foreigner just like Ruth. He had nothing. Right, and he lived tirelessly. He preached the gospel. He taught. He healed people. He exerted so much energy, and he experienced no rest all the way up until his death on a cross. And that's why the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians 1:7, in Jesus we have redemption. In Jesus we have redemption. He is our kinsman redeemer. Imagine for a moment what it would have been like to be in Ruth's shoes. Hopeless, hungry, to say, would you redeem me? Would you be my redeemer? And he says, I will redeem you, Ruth. And in those moments, he was saying, I will provide for you. Ruth, you will never be hungry again. Ruth, I will protect you. You don't have to fear anything, fear any harm anymore. Ruth, I will give you a new name. Though you are an outsider in this land and an immigrant, I will adopt you, take you in as my own and provide for you. And imagine what joy would have filled her heart in that moment. And that's what we can experience as well. You see, Ruth is a great model, a great picture of what it looks like to come to Jesus. Right? Ruth could have just been in the fields, just believing intellectually, I think he's a kinsman redeemer. I think that's who he is. Right? But she didn't do that. Even though God was sovereign and happened to place her in his field, she still had to take action. She still had to take initiative. And so she did. She followed Naomi's plan to come to Boaz. She fell at his feet in the posture of humility. But she was going to give up her old life. She was going to give up a life of striving and gleaning and picking up scraps and living a joyless life. She was giving all that up and laying at Jesus' feet and saying, would you give me rest? Would you redeem me? She took action. She had to ask for it. The same is true for us in Jesus. We don't just become a Christian automatically. We actually have to take bold initiative. We have to take bold faith, and we have to come to the feet of Jesus and ask. We have to come to him personally and ask and say, would you be my redeemer? And to hear the words, yes, I will redeem you. And so this morning, I want to call you guys. Right? If you've been around for a while, if you've maybe been in a church your whole life, but have never come and personally sat down at the feet of Jesus and said, will you be my redeemer? And to hear those words from him, I would ask that you would do that today. Like, would you take advantage like Ruth in faith, come to Jesus and say, would you be my redeemer? There's just two options that you have. You can either spend your whole life laboring for your rest, or you can give yourself to a man who's offered to labor for your rest. Who has already labored for your rest and purchased your rest on the cross. Like, would you choose him today if you haven't?